Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
So joining me today is Martin Summers, Associate Director at GK Strategy, where he leads the firm's ESG, environmental, social, and governance strategies, as well as their sustainability practices. So thanks so much for being here, Martin.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you.
So first, before we get into the nitty-gritty of your piece on cannabis investment, I wanted to know how you came to write about the topic in the first place, insofar as how do you see it fitting in with your overall research and work?
Sure. Okay. If I just break that down slightly into two, there's one bit which is the professional reason I'm writing, and then there's the sort of personal and political reasons I'm writing or doing research in this area. Just to know, GK Strategy is a strategic research and communications consultancy. We work a lot with investors. We pioneered political and regulatory due diligence for investors looking to invest in assets that operate in politically sensitive and highly regulated markets. And cannabis rather obviously counts as one of those things. So that's part of our interest. You know, we've worked on over 300 deals totaling about $15 billion over the last 10 years. Some of that's been political and regulatory, some of that's been more on the sort of responsible investing, ESG or sustainability side. And we also work with companies who operate in these sectors. So one of the reasons I'm writing about this is professionally I've done due diligence on drinks companies and on a vaping company. And I've also worked in-house at British American Tobacco for some time, and I'm familiar with a lot of the sort of harm reduction debates that cover both tobacco, vaping, alcohol, drugs of all types, and so on. So that's one of the reasons I'm interested. What led me to write on this was that I felt that a lot of the work done on cannabis was too focused just on cannabis, in the sense that there are lots of very similar market dynamics in vaping and drinks and coffee. So the cannabis market, though it depends on whether you're talking about the CBD, recreational, THC markets, or however you want to cut the market, they're somewhat similar to, for example, vaping. So vaping has a very busy market, and there's a mixture of hobbyists who entered the market, people who used to own mobile phone shops and still operate mobile phone shops, often while selling vaping products. So you've got some very sort of small-scale entrepreneurs, you've got some big players, you've got some small to medium-sized players, and it's quite a messy market, and there are lots of issues around customer journey, which I think is crucial in cannabis, but which has been neglected. A lot of issues around harm reduction, which is similar to cannabis, and a lot of issues around the appeal and access to underage people or youth, which can variously be counted as anybody under 18 or anybody under the age of 25. So lots of similar issues, but I felt that lots of lessons from vaping and the alcohol sectors weren't really being used when looking at the cannabis sector. So that's one. From a personal and political point of view, I've been arguing for drug legalization since I was a student over 20 years ago. So for me, politically, this is a really big issue. And it's amazing and really satisfying to see this now becoming a huge wave.
Right.
And it's really exciting, really interesting. And you know, it's a thoroughly good thing in most dimensions as long as it's handled well. So that's where I'm coming from. And just, you know, as I lead our firm's ESG and sustainability practice, one of my concerns and interests is, it's twofold. One is, what does a responsible and sustainable cannabis sector look like? What are the dynamics? What are the regulations? What's the structure of the sector? What's the level of professionalization? What sort of benchmarks are people using? And then at a more asset-specific level, it's, well, what does a responsible cannabis company look like? And at the moment, remarkably, there is very, very little work and research about what a responsible cannabis company would look like.
Right.
And most of the stuff that's been done has been fairly top-level screening work for institutional investors, which is useful, but it doesn't give you a sufficiently strong framework to say, well, given the nature of the product, the nature of the sector, what should a responsible investor, whether it's private equity or an individual or a venture capitalist or a big company looking to take a big stake, what should they be looking for?
Right. I mean, there's so much to tease out of that. First, you mentioned customer journey. What does that mean really in the cannabis sector specifically, since it's something that is so new and has been done, you know, has been treated as an illicit drug, and so customer journey is a non-existent so far. What is that looking like right now?
Okay, so just to be clear about terms, customer journey these days means almost anything from when you click on a website to when you walk into a store, what your customer experience is like, what happens when you call customer services afterwards, do you have a complaint? Also, how are you upsold? You know, when you get your, you know, start off buying a particular product, what are you then introduced to, either online or in person? Mm. So it covers the full gamut of everything beyond just the, you know, one-off transactional purchase. So it's almost every sort of touch point, but I guess there's a particular sort of narrative or particular journey that a company might put the customer on, or that the customer sort of accidentally has. Mm. And I think one of the benefits of where vaping from in the vaping sector and in the US cannabis sector is that there's a lot of emphasis on the retail environment, because certainly in a lot of US states, you can't advertise online. So there's much more emphasis. You actually have to go into somewhere and you have to speak to somebody. Now, for those people who've been long-time users, the customer journey is somewhat familiar. It's just legal. You don't have to go through all, whether you're a producer or a user, you just don't have to go through the same sort of rigmarole and anxiety about law enforcement, potential imprisonment, or being sacked at work. So for those users, the customer journey, what's the big deal? You know, they just get more consistent quality, they get a better range of products, and they might have a familiar face. But this is where, but it's very, very different from, let's say, somebody whose only familiarity with cannabis was smoking over 25 years ago. It's very different from somebody who's never used it, or somebody who's doing it specifically because, not because they want to get high in the old-fashioned recreational sense, but because they desperately need to relax, or they've got persistent pain problems that conventional medicine has not helped. So what do you, for those people, they are starting their journey from scratch in many ways, or starting afresh. And in those cases, you want somebody who's well-trained, who can actually take you through that. Now, to this extent, that's not very dissimilar from what happens in really good vape shops, because somebody who's a smoker will come in and say, you know, I've tried some vaping products, it doesn't work for me. Can you educate me about what might work for me in terms of the actual device, the delivery device, the actual product, what strength's good for me, what I might like in terms of flavor? Somewhat similar with cannabis. And I think one other thing is, there should be more of an emphasis on, again, this is all about what's the picture of the responsible sector. What does the customer journey, responsible customer journey look like?
That's really interesting. To sort of take a step back and look at things at a larger scale, at the current moment, and I know things in the UK have changed, you know, as recently as legalization in November, but how would you characterize the current investment landscape in the UK and maybe Europe as a larger market? But what is that like?
In terms of the investor landscape, I think there's probably two things to bear in mind. One is that the interest, the UK is an important hub simply because lots of deals are done here and there's lots of infrastructure for doing deals. So most of the companies advising on or providing investment banking services or otherwise are located in the UK. So there's a lot of interest in the UK. And there's interest mainly at this stage, mainly in the sort of pharmaceutical end of the market or the medicinal cannabis end. The other bit of investment activity is, let's say, with a lot of US companies looking to, sorry, not US, but Canadian companies looking to expand in Europe. And some of these will be, for example, there's some well-established research partnerships have been set up to help with their penetration into the UK, into the European market.
And you mentioned that even professionally, but personally, this has been something that you've been invested in a long time, personally invested. How have you noticed a change, maybe even in the last 5 years? 5 years ago, you know, how was the landscape that you just described to me?
Okay, so in investment terms, there just really wasn't a market at all. There was just wasn't there. There was interest, but very little activity. In terms of if you've anybody wanted to track this, a really simple way to perhaps track how this has gone is just to track what the Mayo Online has said over the last 5 years about cannabis. And it's really fascinating because originally the Daily Mail, and there were lots of other newspapers, but it's quite easy. The Mail Online has written lots and lots about this. Originally, the anxiety was about the very, what was seen as the inevitably damaging effects of cannabis. And there was quite a lot of, I think, justifiable hysteria about the impact on certain, in terms of inducing psychosis amongst very high THC strains, sometimes called skunk. So, but over time, they've changed dramatically. So something only, I think it's about 2 weeks ago, there's this great, you know, very celebratory piece about a woman in her early 50s who'd helped her husband with pain relief in his like final years. And this was and she started producing, you know, growing now, producing her own oils, I think. And it's a really celebratory, positive piece. So to that extent, it's becoming, the whole debate's becoming normalized, or rather the concept of cannabis. So a lot of the hysteria has gone along. All the stuff about gateway drugs has largely disappeared. So people are now, when they talk about cannabis, they're talking about, well, let's legalize cannabis, not right. If we legalize cannabis, people will be demanding, you know, will naturally
reefer
be
madness.
Yeah, it's got a reefer madness, but also you know, this could, if somebody starts on taking cannabis legally, then they'll start taking heroin with a matter of months or something. Right. You know, so there's none of that sort of gateway talk anymore. And people are now very helpfully making a distinction between, often somewhat badly, between THC, which is the what's known as what you might associate with the sort of recreational or pleasure-focused aspects.
More psychoactive.
Well, it is psychoactive, where CBD isn't. And in terms of a sort of generic branding, then CBD, which is, you know, the main active ingredients in what we might call medicinal cannabis or pharmaceutical cannabis, that is regarded as a good thing. And fortunately, it's now becoming regarded as just, as it were, just another ingredient. And that's where it's really changed. So if we're to sum up, lots more investment activity, lots more investment interest, a lot more understanding of the different ways in which you could invest or get exposure to cannabis. And the nature of the debate politically and in the media has changed a lot. I think there are still a lot of politicians and regulators, and that includes some bodies like NICE, the UK's National Institute for Clinical and Cost Effectiveness, that who are still quite conservative or anxious about these issues. But that will come. And dare I say, the more the Mail Online and others start to talk about CBD in particular in a very positive way, then the debate's going to shift more.
And so it seems like the difference hinges on this public perception, which is definitely shifting, and the fact that now for all of this investment interest that maybe even 5 years ago was there, now there are actual opportunities and avenues for that interest to materialize.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's the investment side of things, and you started touching on it, but regulation seems to be confusing, and even though it has loosened and you know, medicinal cannabis is now legal, it seems that the opportunities to take advantage of the beginnings of deregulation, it's still very murky waters. In your piece, you called it gray regulatory zones.
Yeah.
Why? So can you give us first a characterization of what the situation with regulation is, And secondly, why do you think it remains so sort of a gray zone, so confusing?
Okay, fine. So I'll talk about the UK and different European markets. So the first thing to say is that when people talk about legalization, they typically talk about the removal of headline laws that prevent something from happening. So it's the removal of well-known legal barriers. However, removing that doesn't suddenly mean you end up with a fully functioning legal market in which all the transactions are legal, where everybody's clear about what's legal and what isn't. And it's not just a UK issue, so in lots of cases in cannabis laws across Europe, so for example, from what I understand in Holland, it's legal to sell from coffee shops, the so-called licensed coffee shops in Amsterdam, but there's not an obvious legal route by which you'd be able, as a retailer, be able to purchase the cannabis to then sell. So there are lots of these sort of things, and you'll find in lots of other countries, the markets are grey to the extent, not that the laws are necessarily confusing, but you might be able to produce legally, but not retail legally.
Mm-hmm.
Or you might
there
be able
to be these disconnects.
Yeah, some of these are just, there are disconnects, not so much because of incompetence, but just somehow because that's what it took to get it through politically. Mm-hmm. So it's understandable. People shouldn't get too cross about this, and people should be more patient. And eventually these things will work their way through. But if you are looking at these markets, it's important not just to say, oh, that market's legal, this market. Because if you think about any product, apart from, let's say, really obvious things like, I don't know, selling photocopying paper, you know, there's regulations covering all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to say something really glibly, you know, it's legal to sell alcohol, but that doesn't mean that there are no regulations relating to what type of alcohol you can sell, where you can sell it, how you can communicate it, how you can market it, what consumer claims you can make about it. So people just have to accept that just because something's a market according to, let's say, Weed Index or anybody else, that it's legal doesn't mean the entire market's legal or that it's necessarily fully functioning. So that's one important thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the UK, the issue is that the main issue is that it was legalized, but it can only be prescribed under very specific circumstances by specific doctors. And to that extent, from what I've heard, is there have actually been very few prescriptions written.
Mm-hmm.
NHS prescriptions written, I should say. And so what you've got is what I've called rather clumsily Pleno. So everybody's probably familiar with Brino, as in Brexit in name only. And with Pleno, it's cannabis legalization in name only. Now, this doesn't mean that this is going to carry on for a long time. It means that there's just not sufficient things in place for a functioning legal market to really start to get under steam in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
It is worth saying, for example, there, I think earlier, in the last, certainly this year, a clinic opened in Manchester that was dedicated for private prescriptions. And I think some are due to open in Birmingham, and I think there's another city that's due to open in over this year. So there's another route to it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this, as other people have said, one of the issues is that you find the medicinal or pharmaceutical route opening up a lot more in markets where there's not a single payer.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So, yeah, that's so the NHS is the main payer here. There's some health insurance, but actually the private prescribing market in the UK is very undeveloped for all sorts of products. So, you know, it will be, you know, cannabis legalization in name only, possibly till the end of the year and beyond. But much depends on the new NICE guidelines, which are being consulted on, which will be released in October.
Mm-hmm.
But NICE is typically very conservative, so it's questionable about A, what they'll say, and also the degree to which doctors will choose to act on that if they don't feel they've got enough evidence supporting what they're doing. But
so that brings out two questions for me. So one of the things that I found especially compelling about your article was this argument that these regulatory gray zones are born out of scenarios where institutions aren't really backing up the changes that have been made in the law. And that's really ultimately what you're getting at here too. What do you think is the best way for that to, these two, the institutions and the law, to sort of become reconciled with one another? Do you think that NICE will sort of lead the change to closing this gap and that doctors will then follow suit? Is it more likely that it starts to blossom more, like you were saying, in the private healthcare, even though it's quite small here? How do you see this gap closing, if at all?
So I think, obviously, the NICE guidelines will help. I think also a lot of it will just change. There'll be just more evidence coming out. And when I mean evidence, not just big trials, though it is encouraging that only today the I think one of the national health research institutes in the UK announced they were seeking applications for cannabis related research. So some of the research will help, whether it's in the UK or elsewhere, but that will take time to come to fruition.
Right.
And the institutional aspect of it is not necessarily just at the sort of grand national level of advisory bodies like NICE, but it's also at the level of what other health institutions say, whether it's at a national or a regional level. And the institutional framework also covers things, for example, like, do customs officers have clear guidance on what counts as legal or illegal, what should they prevent coming into the country. So, and at the moment, it would seem from what somebody said to me that that's still unclear. Mm. So there are all sorts of things. And in terms of making real progress on these issues, the main thing that people do is just map it for any particular product.
Right.
And then try and say, well, not just say what are the laws, but what would be, you know, what would enable this market to function much better than it does at the moment?
Right.
Because at the moment, people, you know, there are sort of functioning markets, but then they're not particularly well-informed markets. So you can't make any claims around, let's say, CBD, in the sort of supplements market.
That was something we did a podcast on cannabis a few months ago, maybe actually now. And that was something that I thought I didn't know before and I thought was so interesting, that you can't make health benefit claims around CBD, and especially THC is a no-go. So then it was interesting, you know, we're introducing it into our healthcare system, but don't tell people what it can do. So that I just thought was interesting, and obviously another gap that has to be reconciled.
Okay. I think it's really, people shouldn't get too hung up on this.
Why do you say that?
Because the issue about claims mainly relates to, as well, a pharmaceutical framework.
Mm.
So if you want to license a medicine, I mean a medicine as in a pharmaceutical grade pill, and you want to get a license for it, you have to get a license for particular things it will treat.
Right.
So you know, lots of medicines are legal, but they're only legal to be prescribed in certain situations. Okay, so you can't just get it from your doctor or over the counter just because you want it. I mean, it's restricted, and it's the point about claims that are the issue. That what are you making a questionable claim about your particular product and how it will be used? So that's. But that doesn't prevent there being a broader discussion about the overall category of CBD.
So you're saying it's less a cannabis-specific thing and more a pharmaceutical industry sort of how things are done.
Yeah, so it's not as if they're being particularly punished. I mean, it's true of all sorts of things, like lots of other supplementals.
Right.
So the issue is you can't make specific claims about what it will do when you advertise it or market it or communicate to your consumers. You're restricted what sort of claims you can make. However, that doesn't mean that journalists, scientists, commentators, users can actually, it's not as if they can't say what CBD oil has done for them.
Right.
It's just that you as a producer or retailer can't make a specific claim that if you take this, then your pain will be a lot better.
Right.
I think people need to be a bit clearer about it's around specific claims. That's the main issue.
Well, yeah, thank you for clarifying that. And something I think that is adds to that sort of breakdown is where do people, so this is now, again, sort of on a on an individual level, where would you say are good places for someone who is interested in learning, either as a consumer, as an investor, more about this? It seems like it's hard to find out where your best information sources are. If you had to advise, because on how to be compliance focused, how to make sure that you're, if you want to make an investment, that you're putting your money in, you're using your money wisely, how should you as an individual navigate this market?
Okay, so I'll break that down into several mm-hmm. bits. So it depends on how much early exposure investors want to have to this market. Mm-hmm. So if you're an investor and you're generally interested in the market, but not in a huge rush to get into it, then you might want to wait a bit until some of the much bigger players who aren't pure cannabis players start to take a much more active role. Mm-hmm. So if we keep in mind that CBD in particular will just become another ingredient, you know, like taurine or caffeine, or it's just another thing that mm-hmm. you put in a, you know, food, drink, shampoo, topical, right. you know, topical cream, skincare range, whatever it is. And to that extent, you don't have to make a pure cannabis play to be exposed to the cannabis market.
Mm-hmm.
So those investors might want to ask themselves, what of the main players, whether these are pharmaceutical companies, drinks companies, food companies, indeed some tobacco companies, which of these do you think are best equipped to work in partnership or introduce these things into their existing products or launch standalone ranges? So I think that's one thing to ask. And obviously those sources of data and information are quite easy to find. And it's quite clear how, let's say, the healthcare and beauty markets or the food and beverage markets, is rather more obvious now than it used to be that there are some companies in that space that are far more innovative and more oriented around well-being and health than others are.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one, wouldn't it? There are, I think the main thing to, if people are looking for information about this, you know, I could talk about trusted sources. Financial Times is quite good on this. There is loads of cannabis sites out there. Some, you know, it's quite an established communications network of sources. But the main thing to bear in mind is that it's not so much the reliability of the source, is that the market's moving so fast that you can't really rely on something that's, let's say, in many cases, you can't rely on something that's a month old.
Right.
Because it changes so much. It changes really, really quickly. So I'd say that,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's quite a lot of good market reports out there. And there's just a lot more serious commentary in Financial Times, Economist, and lots of other places. So in terms of the compliance issue or what the laws are, the Weed Index has quite a lot. There's quite a lot of, it's now a lot easier to find information on how the different markets break down.
Hmm.
But again, you're often only getting the sort of top line thing. So I would say if you wanted to understand the Spanish market, it's not enough just to know what the laws are, whether it's recreational or medicinal or pharmaceutical. In the case of recreational in Spain, it's a mixture of sort of decriminalization and the enforcement and people going to social clubs. But you'd have to have a lot of on-the-ground information. It's not just enough to look at what's on the statute book.
Right, exactly. Because
enforcement activity makes a big difference as well.
Mm.
And, you know, people talk about legalization and decriminalization, but there are all sorts of other things in between. So you could say, well, somebody's referred to this as, in some markets you have what they call depenalization. Or in some cases, stuff just isn't enforced. So there are penalties, right. But these are so small that
But it's that you need to have the nuance before you can have a full picture.
Yeah, and also you have to bear in mind that all markets operate according to incentives, and that includes for consumers and producers. If you think that you're going to be subject to huge fines, put in jail, and severely disadvantaged financially and otherwise, then you're not going to go ahead. You're more wet. But in markets where there's a relatively light touch in terms of regulation enforcement, it's not so much of an anxiety. Mm. So,
and if you had to, in just a few words, because it's sort of summing up a lot of the things that we've been talking about, if you had to give advice for a curious investor on how to discern legitimate, worthwhile, in line with regulation opportunities in the cannabis market, what would you advise them? How would you advise them?
I think there are two things to do. One is get to know the sector really well and the particular markets that that company is operating in. And that requires a lot of thorough research. It's not as straightforward as lots of other sectors. And as I say, you really have to know the particular market. And secondly, you should look at the companies in terms of how you'd look at most other companies. You know, you'd look for the same, just as we do when we do due diligence on companies. Mm-hmm. Do these companies seem to have good governance systems in place? Do they have good policies? Do they have any robust certification systems? Are they externally audited? Are there non-exec directors? What are those non-exec directors tasked with? Are they bringing in people from is their approach to the industry, they're just using people who just know about cannabis, or are they bringing in people who know lots of other sectors as well? My impression is that lots of the companies at the moment I've come across, admittedly on the production side, will tend to bring in people from, let's say, other areas of agriculture.
Hmm.
But I think it's a slightly less obvious story about what other sectors people are bringing people in to kind of bring in insight.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, it's a bit too easy to get hung up on the fact it's cannabis. But, you know, ultimately it's the same, roughly, it's the same bunch of consumers.
Right.
We have the same perspectives on things. It's the same bunch of regulators. So it's not as if it sits an entirely, it's not like investing in, let's say, kind of a business that's focused on nuclear power generation, where there's a very, a very tiny set of regulators and a very specific set of issues. Most of the things you need to understand and run a responsible company in the cannabis sector are the same things you'd need to for most other sectors. It does, however, get a lot more complicated with cannabis, not so much, dare I say, because of the regulatory situation, but because cannabis is still incredibly complicated as a plant. We're still trying to get to grips with how all the compounds interact. It's obviously not just THC and CBD, and that's still a matter of huge exploration. But at least the research is being done now and being funded.
Amazing. That was exactly what my last question was going to be. So I think people definitely, you're right, get hung up on the fact that it's cannabis, and it's been such a long road to get here, and public perception has had to sort of overcome these hurdles. I guess the last question I do have is, with all these, again, hurdles that have been overcome, but these gaps between regulation and the law and customer understanding and just product development, the way anything has to, how close would you say that we are to a fully functioning cannabis market where dealing with cannabis as a consumer, as an investor, as an entrepreneur does effectively become actually becomes pretty much like everything else?
Really tough question, actually, because it does depend on what you're dealing with. So in terms of, let's say, the supplementals market, that's getting there, but it's not properly functioning to the extent you don't have particularly well-informed consumers. And it's less, for example, people aren't clear about what sort of dosage would be appropriate or meaningful. So on the supplemental side, there are lots of the features of a fully functioning market, but there's still, it's not functioning to the extent that consumers and producers aren't necessarily knowing what would actually work mm-hmm. or not, or what's appropriate for them. And I should emphasize that fully functioning doesn't mean it has to be completely legal or lightly regulated or right. highly regulated. I mean, a fully functioning market is one where there's sufficient information for people to make good choices. There's sufficient access, however controlled it is. And then there's some form in which producers and consumers and other people can freely exchange information. But again, that can still be very controlled. It just, there has to be some means by which you can do it. And the problem is, there really hasn't been many.
Mm.
So on the recreational side, that will take a very long time. And in Europe, that will largely be, I suspect, small iterative steps around decriminalisation, mm-hmm. depenalisation. And it will be inevitably quite hazy. For the overall cause of cannabis, then that's probably a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think more moves to normalise and legalise medicinal, supplemental, and pharmaceutical use, that will help, arguably, the legalization, the cause of legalization for recreational. Mm. So just very quickly, I think pharmaceutical and medicinal and supplemental, that might normalize or start to become open up in a more kind of structured, predictable fashion in 5 to 8 years. Recreational could be, 8 to 10 years, but this whole scene moves very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not much evidence that there's a huge ratcheting back or pushback so far. So it's all generally going in the same direction. It's just kind of by degree. Also, it's difficult to know which bit of the market will open up more in mm-hmm. which particular countries.
Right.
So in some markets, you might see quite a lot more opening up of pharmaceutical, but not much medicinal. Or it could be, multi-stream. It's mm-hmm. It will work to different timetables. So.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come talk to us. The ins and outs of the cannabis market are so nuanced as we saw. So having your expertise is essential.
That's
so
great.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.